You are listening to a free podcast of The Majority Report with Sam Cedar. To support the show and receive nearly an hour extra material daily, become a member today at majority.fm. Resistance is futile.
The Majority Report with Sam Cedar.
The destiny of America is always safer in the hands of the people than in the conference rooms of any elite.
Sam Cedar.
They are unanimous in their hate for me, and I welcome their hatred.
We must guard against the acquisition of unwarranted influence, whether sought or unsought, by the military-industrial complex.
The Majority Report with Sam Cedar.
If I get the feeling you've been cheated...
It is Monday, July 30th, 2012. My name is Sam Cedar. This is the Majority Report. We are broadcasting live in the literal, though not metaphorical, shadow of the New York Times building in the fashionable Dollar Lunch District of New York City. Today on the program, after having sat in a hearing room in Washington last Thursday, listening to Tim Geithner explain why the LIBOR thing, we're on it. It just took us a long time to really get on it. We'll be host of Viewpoints, or excuse me, Current Viewpoint, Elliot Spitzer. Also on today's program, Mitt Romney, having left his European vacation in shambles, now heads to Israel and tells the Israelis, you didn't build that. And speaking of Europe, the Olympics started Friday night with quite a opening show, the highlight of which, of course, was their full-throated celebration of an effective health insurance and health delivery system. And Bill Keller has two pieces today. Came out in the New York Times. Try and figure out which one is actually the fraud and the fake piece put out by the Yes Men. A couple of court cases to report on. And speaking of leaks, people are starting to realize that austerity is hurting our economy. In this country, that and a lawsuit. This is quite interesting, actually. Lawsuit filed last week. Two California women are suing General Mills, claiming that they have been deceptively marketing their Nature Valley products as being natural, when in fact they contain highly processed ingredients. Two California mothers are doing this. And I go through this with my kid all the time. Basically let her eat what she wants, as long as there's not like a lot of corn syrup and a lot of... I basically give her the back of the package. And I said, if you can pronounce what's there, you can eat it. It just makes it easier. These women are seeking to turn the suit into a class action that would win profits the company has made selling Nature Valley products that contain processed ingredients. One of the mothers, though, however, says that the real reason why they're filing suit is just to increase awareness that when you go into a supermarket and you see all natural, it isn't really all natural. Consumers, apparently, according to surveys, show that prefer foods that are described as natural as opposed to organic. However, organic products actually must meet some type of verifiable standards by the federal government, whereas natural means basically nothing. The lawsuit's been filed in the U.S. District Court of Northern District of California. It says that General Mills has been engaging in false advertising and anti-competitiveness under California law. At issue are three ingredients: high fructose corn syrup, high maltose corn syrup, and maltodextrin, which apparently is a sweetener and a thickener. High maltose corn syrup and maltodextrin are highly processed and do not exist in nature. And not even under the most elastic possible definition could they be considered natural, says attorney Michael F. Jacobson. He's the executive director of the Center for Science and the Public Interest, an advocacy group that works on public health issues and is serving as co-counsel. The FDA recently denied an application by the Corn Refiners Association of America to change the name of high fructose corn syrup to corn sugar. Corn sugar sounds so much better. Consumer groups had fought the application because some consumers have adverse reactions to the substance and might be confused by the less specific identification. It's basically a made-up thing. There is no such thing as corn sugar. Any more than, like, coolant is coolant sugar. Just because it's sweet does not mean that it's actually sugar. Early onset bipolar disease, attention deficit hyperactive disorder, and obsessive compulsive disorder, and anxiety were diagnosed in one of the mother's daughters at age six. After doing research, the mother, who apparently teaches agriculture at Kern County, California, decided to eliminate all foods with dyes and processed ingredients from her daughter's diet to try and control her condition. And she's cut out all additives, preservatives, dye, everything. After 2 years of doing that, she claims that all of those, that her daughter has been released from all those diagnoses. Take it for what it will, but it's what you will. But one thing is clear, that it's not natural if it's not natural. And you should not be able to label it as such. Hopefully that will get a little attention. We got to take a break. When we come back, we will be talking to Elliot Spitzer on LIBOR and this guy, Sandy Whale, who apparently says we should break up the too big to fail banks. The grandfather of the too big to fail banks has basically said, I no longer like my grandchildren. We'll take a break. We'll be right back. We are back. Sam Seder on the Majority Report on the phone. It's a pleasure to welcome to the program the host of Viewpoint on Current, as well as a writer whose work appears in things like Slate and all over the web, Elliot Spitzer. Welcome to the program.
Thank you. Always a pleasure to be chatting with you.
So you were down in the hearings to hear Tim Geithner explain why regulators Well, I don't know if they did anything ever about LIBOR. I guess ultimately they did, but they took their own sweet time. What was his explanation?
Well, it was kind of circuitous, but what it is distilled down to, and I don't want to make his case. I've obviously been critical of the Fed at many levels, and this is one more example of their failure to perform their primary job, which is to regulate the securities and financial markets. They knew that there were serious allegations of impropriety in the LIBOR market. They actually had phone calls, recorded phone calls, from people in the market giving chapter and verse of every element of criminal conduct, of bid rigging and other improper behavior. And in that context, what they did was send a memo saying, here's some ways you might improve it. But they didn't say, hey, guys, there's criminal conduct. There's market bid rigging going on. There is false reporting. They then continued to use LIBOR as the basis for the debt that was issued and loans that were made by the Fed to other institutions, even as they had evidence that LIBOR itself was being manipulated. So certainly not the sort of aggressive behavior one would expect when you're told that the single most important interest rate in the financial markets is being manipulated. So again, look, on the one hand, I think it's a fair point that we shouldn't get distracted by blaming the regulators when the overt criminal conduct was being done by the bankers. On the other hand, for those of us who've been saying that the Fed structurally needs to be reexamined, and that when Tim Geithner was there, the Fed was really a partner of the banks rather than their regulator, I think this is one more chapter in that saga.
Why can't the LIBOR just be a function of the rates that these banks got the night before?
Look, there are so many different ways that you could come up with a number. Now, understand, LIBOR is meant to be essentially the cost of capital to the banks, so that they say, look, if it costs us, and this, I hate to talk about arcane banking stuff, but if it costs a bank 3% to borrow, then it will lend out at something above that. It needs to make a profit. And so one of the critical components should be its cost of capital. And this is a mechanism to determine that. So you could come up with 100 different ways to determine their cost of capital. And in fact, before LIBOR was the base of most of the debt 15, 20 years ago, there were other numbers that were used. Many people think LIBOR is flawed because, not get too technical, it goes to your marginal rate rather than the average rate, so it shouldn't move all of the debt that is being issued. Put that all aside. There are a lot of different alternatives that should be and probably could be embraced.
Is this indicative of just sort of the whole financial or the vast amount of the financial markets basically just being rigged?
And Sam, here's what you're seeing. Once more, you have a self-regulatory process that utterly failed. And if this were the first time this story had been told, then maybe the people in the markets could say, look, somebody messed up this one time. We've learned. We'll move forward. The problem is, every time there has been a self-regulatory body that has been designed and charged with the obligation to oversee the structure of our capital markets, they failed. They have not lived up to their task. They have not stepped in to find the myriad violations that are there. So as if we needed one more message of this type, it is certainly a very powerful statement that self-regulation doesn't work. For those of us who've been trying to scream from the hilltops for years, get smart, guys, we're capitalists and believe in markets, but markets need to be overseen, just like you need a ref on a football field or at the Olympics. The sports run because you have refs. The financial markets are the only place we still say, oh, gee, we'll trust you to make your own calls. Doesn't work.
And it seems, to the extent that there are regulators, that they're either heavily outmatched or they are almost indistinguishable from the people that they're supposed to be regulating.
Yeah, that I think is so much a part of the story, that the New York Fed emotionally was an extension of the financial services sector. And this is why, again, the issue of the board of directors of the New York Fed has on it the CEOs of major banks. They pick the president of the New York Fed, and until recently, that got changed recently, thankfully. But they control the psyche of the institution because not only the revolving door, but there is just this, they see it as a symbiotic relationship between the Fed and the banks, instead of recognizing that, wait a minute, where they are not as adversaries emotionally, but adversaries in the sense of we've got to make sure that the temptation to do things that are improper doesn't override your sense of obligation to the marketplace.
And just as I think the LIBOR story broke, there was also a piece, I think it was in the Times, about essentially the front running that's going on with between hedge fund managers and sort of the system of, I guess, cough twice if your analyst is going to come out with something that's
Look, front running is one of the oldest games out there because, I mean, just so folks understand, if I know that a big client of mine is going to put in a big buy order, that's going to drive the price of a stock up. If I sneak in ahead of him and buy the stock now before it moves up, then put in the order, and then sell, I get a little gain. You do it often enough, you get very, very wealthy. It's the same thing as if I know an investment bank is going to say, instead of selling that stock, you should buy it and upgrade in the analytical work that's out in the marketplace. That's going to move the stock up. I go in and buy ahead of that or sell if it's a downgrade. I'm front-running, violating all sorts of rules and obligations. But not surprisingly, it goes on, and it goes on with greater frequency than anybody wants to admit.
And tell me what you made of Sandy Weill coming out last week. Essentially, I mean, it's fairly accurate to say that this guy's the grandfather of the too-big-to-fail banks, right? I mean, and now he's disowning his grandchildren? I mean, what?
You know, I wish it were that simple, but it, you know, this, you know, someday I'll have grandkids. I don't want to let them think it's simple to disown them. I don't plan to do it. But this was an unbelievable moment. Sandy Weill was the one. He was one of the great deal makers of the 80s. People loved him. He's a gregarious sort. He was the one ideologically who said bigger, bigger, bigger. Bigger is better. We want every bank to merge so that you're a commercial bank and an investment bank. He put Citibank and Travelers together and said, never mind that there's a law that precludes it. We'll get Congress to repeal that law. And the financial services industry was so strong, they did. They repealed Glass-Steagall. After they did it retroactively to permit this deal to go through, it was kind of a remarkable parable of how and where the power was. Now, all these years later, he's saying, oops, it didn't work so well. And on the one hand, you want to say congratulations for the intellectual integrity that you know, are showing in recognizing this and acknowledging the error, and that is important because I think it now leaves the few folks out there who are still justifying those mergers kind of with no friends left. On the other hand, you want to say, man, you're responsible for some really grievous, horrendous stuff. I mean, think what has happened to our economy to a great extent because we completely deregulated financial services. We let this ugly stuff happen. It has destroyed, these bubbles have destroyed our economy. So on the one hand, yeah, Sandy disowned his kids, which are the big banks. On the other hand, so you want to say congratulations, but you also want to say you were fundamentally wrong, and now even you acknowledge it.
Now, does Bob Rubin have to give back his salary as executive vice president of Citigroup, or is that does he get to keep that money?
No, I think my guess is he's got it well invested. You know, look, this is one of the great tensions in the Democratic Party, obviously. The sort of iconic leaders who were there with President Clinton fully embraced this this move. And Bob Rubin, as you're suggesting, went over to Citibank afterwards, was the non-executive chair, I think may have been the title, got paid oodles of money. And, you know, this was the ideology. It was those of us who were at the time and for years were saying, guys, this is a dangerous, dangerous path, were in the distinct minority back then, and it was screaming in the wind. I think the history is now increasingly written and obvious that it was a grievous error. And when you have Sandy Weill coming out and saying, hey, yeah, not a good idea, I think the story has now been finally concluded.
Do you think the Democrats have in any way change their perspective on this? I mean, I don't see any evidence that they're any less sort of, I guess, in the pockets of the big banks. I mean, I think, you know, Tim Geithner, his presence in the administration, and I think, you know, and Bob Rubin's influence on the administration, he may have been there were it not for a scandal that tied him up, I guess, in the fall of 2009 or 2008. Is there any indication that the Democrats have changed their perspective on this in any shape or manner?
Well, I would say somewhat. I mean, not enough, obviously, but I mean, certainly with respect to Tim Geithner, I think not nearly enough. And Tim was not, even when Dodd-Frank was moving through, was not a fan of the vocal rule, was not a fan of the necessary steps that, and positions and policies that were put in place in Dodd-Frank, some of which are good, that are critically important. Barney Frank pushed a good bill. It doesn't go as far as I would like. There's something called the Safe Banking Bill that would go farther. But I think some voices there were, Sherrod Brown and others, were pushing more fundamental restructuring. So there are voices in the Democratic Party that are better. Treasury Department was not among them. And I think over time, again, that is becoming increasingly clear. I think what we've got to do now is make sure that, since we're not going to get any new legislation through a Congress constituted as it is right now with Republicans controlling the House, and as you say, the Democrats not pushing anything more vigorous, what we need to do is make sure that the Volcker rule is properly and rigorously interpreted to at least minimize the risk from proprietary trading that can still be imposed on the system.
I don't know if you've had a chance to read the book. Obviously, you've got you have a lot of people on to interview. You got to read a lot of books. I'm in the same boat. But
right.
Has Borofsky, Neil Borofsky's book, who was the former Inspector General of the TARP, has there been any revelations that you think came out of there that were new? Or certainly specifics they were, but.
Yeah, and here's what I'd say. Neil is a friend, and I think it's a spectacular book. I don't know. I think thematically it is, again, additional evidence of what we knew, suspected, believed. I think he tells it. It's a great book. It's a great read. He and I had him on the show last week. He tells the story with a texture and with a granularity that makes it real in his personal interactions with Tim Geithner and the battles that he waged to make the Treasury Department more and the TARP program more sympathetic to homeowners, for instance. When the Treasury Department was bailing out the banks, it did not do anything of magnitude for homeowners, and that was both wrong ideologically and wrong economically. The weight and the drag on the economy because homeowners are still burdened by too much debt that has not been probably reformed is what's keeping our economy from, or at least one of the factors that's growing, keeping our economy from growing. But Neil tells the story in a spectacular way. He's a good storyteller, and he was there in the trenches, so I think he can bring more than an academic light to it.
It seems to me that there were many who sort of suspect this from an outside perspective, but there seems to be almost a hostility. Well, a hostility towards homeowners. I mean, when you look at HAMP and how it was designed, I mean, we all know that it was incredibly ineffective at providing loan modifications for underwater homeowners, but it really does in his telling, seem less about incompetence, but in fact achieving exactly what the goal was from the administration perspective, which is essentially just buy the banks more time with the hopes that somehow things will turn around.
You know, I think that's right. And I try hard not to challenge motive or impute motive where there's not compelling evidence, but certainly we know that the urgency that attached to pushing money, blank checks almost, into the coffers of the banks, so that their solvency would be secured. And I'm of the school of thought that we needed to do something. We couldn't let the banks go bankrupt. But the other piece of that that was ignored to, again, as I say, both ideologically and economically disastrous consequences was the plight of homeowners. And that was apparently second, third, fourth thought so far down the rung of the considerations that it was not done, not pushed, and at the moment where there was leverage over the banks because Treasury said, look, you need the money, we're giving it to you, but here are the things you must do to reform home mortgages. Once they had the banks had the money, the leverage was gone. So the failure to negotiate was a grievous tactical error. The failure to appreciate how important it was to do this was the strategic error.
Do you think that, I mean, given the chance to do it over, they would do it differently? I mean, I still get the sense that this was more, this is less about sort of a good analysis of what would fix the problem and more about maybe ideology isn't the right word, but almost some type of religion that this is just simply, it's just not the American way to help out homeowners directly.
I don't know. I've got to believe they would do it differently now, if only because our economy is still I guess tepid is the word of the moment. I mean, we don't want to say we're in a disastrous dynamic. I mean, we're growing at about 1.5 points the last quarter, but certainly we are in not the shape anybody wants to be in. Job growth is close to stagnant. We'll see Friday what the last month's job numbers look like. But everybody acknowledges homeowners and the excess debt. There's still an enormous weight on the economy. So I've got to believe they would do it differently because it hasn't worked out.
Right. All right. Well, let me ask you one more question sort of off
sure.
of the this is more on your former politician beat. When you
right.
see Mitt Romney, I mean,
I
literally every couple of days, I am just more and more astonished that this guy could be this bad of a politician. I mean, even almost putting aside his complete what seems to be a complete lack of policy formulations
mm-hmm.
for just about anything. How is it this guy's been running for president for 7 years and he's so bad at this?
It beats me. He is, and I routinely describe him as the most awkward politician I've ever seen. There's just a sort of hesitancy in every interpersonal dynamic that I almost feel embarrassed now commenting on it, making fun of him, because I say it's just kind of too icky to talk about. But, I mean, you go over to London. You're there as their guest. You're trying to you're visiting London, the home of the Olympics, our longest ally historically, and you kind of throw water in their face. It's like, whoa, come on. You don't do that just as a matter of interpersonal dynamics, let alone a candidate. Sometimes you have a hard time fathoming what gear is not turning the right way. But it is just hard to watch sometimes.
Does this guy have advisors? I don't understand how this happens. Because it seemed like he wasn't really, this was not a hard question that he got from Brian Williams when he did that. I mean, this was a total throwaway question. He seemed like he was hitting talking points, like he wanted to remind people of what he did, and it seems completely tone deaf.
You know, it could be that he, I mean, this is the best defense I've heard of him in this context. He is so coldly analytical that he cannot just give you the polite chit-chat answer. How do you find London and you're ready for the Olympics? Instead of saying, oh, it's wonderful, it's great, I can't wait, here's my favorite event, you know, this is I can't wait for the opening ceremonies, it's going to be cool. Just something that nobody will remember but is pleasant and upbeat. Instead, he's got to give you the, well, you know, I saw three things that didn't go quite right, so let's talk about them. It's like, whoa, guy, chill out. Be normal. I don't know. I don't get it. But who am I to say?
I would love to see this guy like being invited to a wedding and just watch him show up and just be like, this band is horrible. Wow, I hate that gown that she's wearing. I mean, this is just,
you know,
this is, it's just unbelievable.
Something hard to fathom.
It really
something
is.
Something hard to fathom.
Well, Elliot Spitzer, host of Viewpoint on Current, thanks so much for taking the time to speak with
us. Sam, always great to chat with you.
Okay. We're going to take a break, folks. And when we come back, Mitt Romney in Israel, sort of hitting both those agenda points. Let's promote an attack on Iran. And also, let's crap on Palestinians. Wonderful. Just wonderful. Also, Bill Keller's two columns over the past 2 days, one of which is fake, almost impossible to tell, except for one actually makes a little more sense. And here's a little hint. That's the fake one. We're going to take a break. We'll be right back.
Everybody's coming home for lunch.
So Mitt Romney, continuing on with his European vacation, leaves Europe and heads to Israel to have a huge fundraiser with his American supporters, I guess, presumably his right-wing American Jewish supporters. He was seated at a U-shaped conference table with 40 donors, including Las Vegas casino mogul Sheldon Adelson. And Romney said, this is this, I don't know why this isn't getting more controversy, because Romney's basically saying that Israel didn't build this. Check this out. I come to this place, therefore, with a sense of profound humility. Incidentally, $25,000 to $50,000 you needed to raise to attend this event. All the donors are U.S. citizens, and they flew to Israel from the United States to be with Romney during his 36-hour visit to Jerusalem. With a sense of pure, profound humility, as I look around here at great people who've accomplished a great thing, as he's looking at these 40 donors, he expects to raise more than $1 million from, who are all from the United States. And also a sense of spiritual connection, acknowledging the hand of providence in establishing this place and making it a holy city. Basically coming right out and telling, I guess, the Israelis, you didn't build this. God also, or either God or... I don't think he means Providence, Rhode Island, right? I mean, that would be weird. He went on at this, I believe it was at the King David Hotel, where he was giving this speech. He went on and say, as you come here and see the GDP per capita, for instance, in Israel, which is about $21,000, and compare that with the GDP per capita just across the areas managed by the Palestinian Authority, which is more like 10,000 per capita, you notice such a dramatically stark difference in economic vitality. And he told these donors, you have a hard time suggesting natural resources and land account for it all. I recognize the power of culture, which is really at least the power of at least culture and a few other things, he said, which is stunning that he's ignoring the fact that you have occupied territory and, well, you have, I mean, he's been called racist for saying this, and I think to a certain extent there's a good argument. It's also just sheer stupidity. Because it's not just culture that is in some way inhibiting the GDP of the Palestinian people. Saeb Erekat, a senior aide to the Palestinian President Mahmoud Abbas, told the AP, this man doesn't realize that the Palestinian economy cannot reach its potential because there's an Israeli occupation. It seems to me this man lacks information, knowledge, vision, and understanding of this region and its people. He also lacks knowledge about Israelis themselves. I've not heard any Israeli official speak about cultural superiority, and he's right. Well, I mean, I guess there's a couple. That Avigdor Lieberman, I'm sure, has said something horribly racist about the Palestinians. He says it about just about everybody else, the foreign minister. This is just stunning. He went on also to pronounce Jerusalem the capital of Israel. Effectively, what Romney's doing, aside from showing what an idiot he is, he's also saying, I'm going to make it possible or impossible for the United States to ever, ever, not that there's been a lot of success in the past of this, but to broker any type of deal here. Because I want to go on record, even before I'm president, of making it clear that I think that culturally speaking, the Palestinians are not equal to the Israelis and thus can never be expected to help their own people. I also want to make it clear that I am not an honest broker when it comes to calling any type of negotiations on the final status of Jerusalem, because I'm going to announce it to be Israel's capital. And then I'm also going to make it clear that I'm willing to do just about anything for the you 40 people in this room who are not even Israeli. I should also add that he went on and on about the concept of containment. It was Dan Senor. You remember him, the wildly successful guy who I believe was the spokesperson for the CPA in Iraq. And Senor said, he's Mitt Romney's foreign policy spokesperson, because you remember Mitt Romney's other foreign policy spokesman, the one who was not so heavily associated with the failure of Iraq, turned out to be gay, which is apparently much worse for foreign policy when you're a Republican. And so they forced him out. Dan Senor said, there are really two clocks, in referencing the concern that Israel may be planning to attack Iran. There are really only two clocks. There's the clock determining the speed at which Iran is developing the capability, and there is a clock that would preclude Israel from taking action. Also, there's a range of these estimates around, but I think everyone understands, U.S. officials and officials around the world, that we are dealing with an inevitability at the pace in which we're going that's not far off. So the at issue here is not the actual development of a nuclear weapon. It is the development of the capability to develop a nuclear weapon. Reviving the doctrine that essentially was the Iraq war. Preventative war. Not preemptive, because preemptive implies something's going to happen. We're going to stop it. Preventative is we're going to stop the chance that something could be happening that we would stop. So it just gives you a sense of there is a difference here when we're talking about policy regarding Iran. And Romney is just as bloodthirsty as we can expect from any other Republican nominee and makes no attempt to hide that. Now, I don't think the Israelis, frankly, can actually believe that they can achieve anything by attacking Iran. Seems highly unlikely to me that they would actually bomb Iran. They'll send over assassins with U.S. okay to kill some scientists. But the idea of them bombing them seems absolutely ridiculous. But it's a great thing to promote if you're looking for to get essentially a fellow Likudnik in the office, i.e. Romney. And by Likudnik, I mean someone who is not necessarily a supporter of Israel, but a supporter of the hard right wing in Israel. And, of course, once you get a Romney in there, the idea that there would be any pushback on what happens with the Palestinians, as if there's any really right now, is greatly diminished. But that's Mitt Romney for you. All right, folks, that is the first half of our program.
If you want to participate in the conversation, you can call me at 646-257-3920 in the second half of the program. We give you half the show for free with the hopes that you'll become a member to support the existence of that show. And then as a bonus, if you support the program, we give you another 50 minutes. How do you like them apples? You can become a member today at majority.fm. It's quite reasonable considering what you pay for a cup of coffee. You get a month's worth of shows for $10. And you also get all that extra material for just $10. So become a member today. We really need your support. Weekends are the slowest time for members to join. We just don't get them. All right. We're going to take a break, head into the better half of the program. 646-257-3920. The IM machine is on. You can IM me at Majority FM through your AOL Instant Messenger, or you can IM me through majorityfm@jabber.org. Put that into whatever client that you use. And the better half, the Yes Men and WikiLeaks pull a prank on Bill Keller. As far as I know, it's only an op-ed that he didn't write, should have written, about WikiLeaks. But there's an argument to be made that somebody also faked a piece he wrote on why we should cut Social Security, because that one seems like a bigger joke. We're going to take a break. When we come back, we will discuss that and more right back after this.